This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today we air a forum on trade wars, tariffs, and U.S. economic policy in the global market. Free and unfettered trade has been a lasting cornerstone of U.S. policy since World War II, with the U.S. making itself increasingly interconnected with global trade and supply chains. However, the free trade status quo has garnered a long list of both domestic and foreign critics, including President Donald Trump and Director of Trade and Manufacturing Policy, Peter Navarro. Central to the economic policy adopted by the White House has been the use of tariffs, reduction of trade deficits, and rejection of multilateral trade deals like NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. These challenges to mainstream economic thought have been especially visible in the ongoing U.S. trade war with China, the second largest economy in the world. The reciprocal escalation of tariffs on billions of dollars worth of goods between the U.S. and China has created ripples in the U.S. and global economies, and caused uncertainty to rise in agricultural, manufacturing, and investment markets. Within the last week, the announcement of Phase 1 of a U.S.-China trade deal saw President Trump defer October 15th tariff hikes in exchange for China's promise to purchase an additional $10 billion in agricultural products. While the announcement of the potential deal's Phase 1 was met with a flurry in stock market activity, the details and success of Phases 2 and 3 are still an open question. And so on today's show, we present a recent conversation about trade, discussing the issues of a changing U.S. economic policy, trade wars, and tariffs, are Cole Capener, independent director of BMW Brilliance Incorporated, based in Shenyang, China, Miles Hansen, president and CEO of the World Trade Center, Utah, and Rudy Van Arnim, associate professor in the economics department at the University of Utah. Moderating the discussion is Natalie Gochner, director of the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. This forum was recorded on September 30th, 2019. Here is moderator Natalie Gochner.
I'm going to ask each of the panelists real quickly to just give us a 1 to 2 minute kind of contextual introduction to their background and their views about the trade war issue. And Miles, we'll start with you.
First off, I apologize about my voice. I went to a football game Saturday night. There was a lot of rain. It was really cold, but the outcome was fantastic.
Sounds like you were at the right game.
Exactly. That's right. So my voice is still a little bit hoarse from that, but it's fantastic to be with you today. Very briefly, hats off to all of you studying Asian affairs, economics, politics. These are issues that are so important now, but will become increasingly important in the years and decades to come. And what we're going to be talking about today is all those coming together in a very significant way that impacts not only our country and our state, but also businesses and people and workers and consumers here in the state of Utah. And so you're learning critical skills and developing expertise in an area that's so important moving forward. Very briefly on my background, grew up here in Utah, worked for the State Department, served as a diplomat in Saudi Arabia, in Dubai working on Iran issues, in Armenia working on Iran issues, and then also in Washington, D.C., and a couple different assignments there. I came back to Utah about a year ago after working at the White House on the National Security Council, working on Middle East issues. And so foreign policy and national security is something that's very near and dear to my heart. Came back to work for World Trade Center Utah. We are an organization that works with the state of Utah and the Utah business community to do international business development for the state of Utah and for Utah companies. So that's both helping companies grow internationally, attracting investment here to the state, and when we're doing that, helping to elevate Utah's status globally as a hub for trade and investment and innovation. So clearly the trade war is something that is affecting Utah companies in a significant way. And we'll talk more about that. But just very quickly, the thing that the greatest impact up to this point has been uncertainty. As you have, as a business, you need to have certainty to make business decisions, whether it's investment or it's hiring people to grow into a new market. And given the uncertainty of the moment, we see a lot of companies trying to figure out exactly what they should do, coming to us hoping that we've got a crystal ball. The answer is we don't. But it is something we are tracking very closely and look forward to discussing more with you today.
That's great. Rudy, share your comments about your background and your sort of contextual thoughts about the trade war.
Thank you. And thanks to the Hinckley Institute and all of you being here. I really think this is great to have these kind of conversations. and to do so here on campus. So my background, I'm an economist, and you know, the famous joke is that if you ask an economist, he'll sell well on the one hand, and then on the other, and or you'll ask five economists, you get 10 different answers. You know, so there are these various ways that you know that people make jokes about economists. They're all right. You know, that's the thing that I'm going to give you different perspectives on this so important issue. But more specifically, my background is that to trade is that. In the early 2000s, I collaborated with then my PhD advisor on a study on the Doha Development Agenda, which was underway to increase trade liberalization between emerging market economies and the advanced economies. And there we used quite standard method to assess these types of trade assessments and. As is so common in economics, if you change some assumptions, you get different results. And we were critically engaged in the debate back then on the effects of these trade assessments. Since then, I have been involved with a group in Vienna that is closely linked to the European Parliament on their assessments of trade, and we've many times testified at the parliament, and have now been added to a consortium of think tanks that are regularly and officially invited to assess European and global trade policy. So the issue is on my desk, so to speak, on an ongoing basis. And I agree with Cole already here that it's a very important issue, and we need to disentangle all the complicated economic and political matters, and hope we can do some of that today in this discussion.
That's great. And Cole, let's hear your introductory comments.
I'm also thankful to be here. I was fortunate to be a Hinckley intern many decades ago. And I'm happy to be here today. My background is really China. I first went to the People's Republic of China in 1981 for business, went back in 83, moved there in 86. And so for the past 33 years, my life has really been inextricably connected with China in various capacities. Sort of the first was as a corporate lawyer with the law firm of Baker & McKenzie, helping multinationals in foreign direct investment in China in the early first 20 years of China's opening up. I was involved in a number of projects. The second hat I wore was in academia as an adjunct professor. I had the opportunity to teach Chinese, mainly Chinese graduate law, finance, and business students at Fudan University in Shanghai, Tsinghua University in Beijing, and Shanghai Normal University. The third hat I had a chance to wear is really to see China from a business operator's perspective. I served as an independent director on the boards of four Chinese companies, two of which were listed on U.S. stock exchanges. And if you've been following the news, the Trump administration just last week floated a proposal to ban Chinese companies from accessing Chinese U.S. capital markets through listing their shares on U.S. stock exchange. The last 16 years, since 2003, its founding, I've been an independent director of BMW's car manufacturing joint venture company in Liaoning Province in Shenyang City. That has been an interesting opportunity for me to see how you know, business operator actually operates in the Chinese investment context. And if you're following the news, at least car manufacturing in China has been a focal point in terms of market access barriers, in terms of tariff protection of tariffs kinds of issues. And these three hats that I've worn sort of inform my critique of Trump administration policy vis-a-vis China. I don't pretend to be a global trade expert, but I can certainly share my views of what I think are some of the problems and opportunities in the Trump administration's asks vis-a-vis China on the trade dispute. I've sort of categorized them into four boxes. Trade balance, box number one. Market access barriers, box number two. Technology, box number three. And industrial policy, box number four. And we'll have opportunities to talk about them, I hope, later.
Looking forward to that, Cole. Okay, so we've got these people that have these extraordinary expertise, whether it's academic, whether it's a diplomat, business expertise, practitioners. Rudy, I want to go to you first and just ask you to pretend like you're being interviewed by the New York Times, just because it's a really important response you have to give here. And you're asked, you know, you're an expert on trade. Is free trade good for the economy?
I'm glad that I get to answer that question and not the fascinating detailed expertise that my co-panelists here have on the China issues. So I'm going to give you the first version of this on the one hand, on the other hand.
We had a feeling that was coming.
So the first thing to say is that there are very strong economic theoretical arguments for the case of free trade. Free trade generates gains in the aggregate if there is specialization across countries. There's no way around that. The case for that argument is very strong theoretically and as well somewhat supported empirically. The main argument to bring forth in support of that argument, in support of that idea, is that larger markets allow for greater specialization. If you have, you can just imagine a manufacturer in a small village in 1750 producing a product that that then services that very small local market. And hence, that manufacturer can put out 100 units or something in a given time period. And if you then fast forward to today, a manufacturer can largely service a global market and sell products to that very large market, and hence has tremendous efficiency gains to make in terms of the cost of production and the productivity of their labor. And that case applies as much between, let's say, New York and San Francisco as it does between New York and Shanghai. There's no difference between that, just that the two countries have different political and regulatory regimes and different currencies. But that's basically the theoretical case for free trade, and there's no way around that. The anti-free traders have to wrestle with that and take it into account in a very serious manner. On the other hand, there are very strong theoretical arguments and quite a bit of empirical support for the idea that free trade generates winners as well as losers within a country. So if it's good for, in the famous example, for England and Portugal to trade cloth and wine from your textbook, or it is good for China and the US to trade auto parts, that creates gains for both of those countries, but in both countries, certain groups in the labor market can be hurt. And that is very likely what has happened in the US, that particularly lower skilled workers have not benefited to the extent that higher skilled workers or the owners of the factories and corporations, or even the owners of ideas, have benefited from the exchange with China as well as other countries.
So Rudy, I'm the New York Times reporter, and I'm like, wow, okay, that's what I expected. This economist gave me both sides of the argument, but I learned something. So I want to go to, I'm going to call you, Cole, a practitioner who's, doing the real kind of work of trying to create a product, sell it, help economies prosper. Do you have a critique of that, or give us some good color commentary? And then I'll go to Miles and just say, give us a look at that from a public official point of view or a diplomat.
Well, I from my perspective, both as an investment advisor or business advisor in my first part of my career, to observing how BMW has prospered in China and how trade has contributed to that, I like the one hand, I guess it's his right hand.
Rudy,
I'm more of a free trader. And because I think I've seen the benefits from two sides, certainly since China joined the WTO in 2001, their GDP has grown dramatically. And that has also created a prospering private sector. So for China, free trade has been a very big winner. But I
lifted millions of people out of poverty potentially, right?
300 million people lifting 300 million people out of abject poverty, below a dollar a day on the poverty line. So, I mean, to me, that's a significant contribution. Private sector growing, big private employment growing. And at the same time, I know the critique is usually that it results in, on your left hand, unemployment on the loser side. And I've looked at some of the I don't pretend to be an economist. I try to look at some of the literature and see that when I've advising Whirlpool setting up a new factory in China, which may or may not lead to a closure of a factory in the United States, what I did see was an enormous growth in employment in a different sort of white-collar support staff for that burgeoning global investment. So it seems to me that there, and I'm not, if you're a blue-collar worker and you lose your job, that's not a good thing, I understand that. But, in terms of net employment gains, I'm not sure that there is net unemployment as a result of free trade. So,
okay. That's good. Miles, so you have spent time not so much in China, but certainly in the diplomatic corps, worked a lot with both career service professionals and political appointees discussing relationships with countries. Give us your reaction to what the two gentlemen have shared.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that trade creates relationships that undoubtedly bring stability to societies, to countries, nations, and then to the rest of the world. So trade, in addition to the economic benefits of trade, there are absolutely benefits to these people-to-people ties that develop as a result of trade. And it's interesting to think about, go back to 1945, the end of World War II, right? Europe was in ashes, much of Asia was in ashes. The world had been decimated with war. And out of that came this rules-based international system for trade. It created this framework that was never applied evenly, but more or less created a framework in which countries would engage in trade. Since World War II until today, we've seen the greatest prosperity and economic growth that the world has ever seen. And it's attributed to a number of different factors, but this rules-based order for trade, this framework, this opportunity for countries to engage in more and more free trade undoubtedly led to very rapid economic development and growth for many, many countries. Within countries, there may be some winners and losers. We can talk about that. But every country that engages in trade comes out as a net winner, in my opinion, in my experience. When thinking of going back to the people-to-people ties, that is something that binds countries together. If you think about Germany and France after World War II, right, there was efforts to create political integration, but that was really based off of economic integration, right? And as those two countries who had fought a series of devastating wars became more and more integrated economically, you saw greater prosperity, saw the relationships of trust develop that made it easier to find common sense solutions to the challenges and issues that have arisen between France and Germany over the past 75 years. And so as we think about trade, it's important to think about not just about the economic benefits that are very, very real and tangible, but about these broader social benefits that arise from peoples from different countries and parts of the world developing these mutually beneficial relationships with each other.
That's Miles Hansen, President and CEO of the World Trade Center, Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, unedited, mostly in their entirety as a public service. Today we are airing a panel discussion given in September on the U.S.'s global economic policy and how it relates to trade wars and tariffs. Here again is moderator Natalie Gochner.
So we're going to get to the T word, the tariff word here, but Miles has given me an introduction to just put out on the table, and I'll get all three of you to respond, but you mentioned this rules-based international order. There's been a clear rejection by the Trump administration of, you know, I'm going to say a half decade of progress on globalization. And if I read from, I believe this is a quote from the UN General Assembly, he said, "The future does not belong to the globalists. The future belongs to the patriots." Like the real quotable line. I'm going to pass it back to Miles real quickly, but let's just do really quick responses. Does that resonate with you? Or are you upset about this disruption to these, you know, international institutions and rules-based trade?
You know, process and rhetoric matter. They matter significantly. And I think that that type of rhetoric is unhelpful. I think that the process the Trump administration has pursued is overly disruptive and overly costly. If you look at the objectives and what we've accomplished since then, I do think that there are many people in the administration that look at this system and they don't want to destroy it. I don't think they would agree with what the president said at the UN, but they do recognize that there are things that could be updated. There are things, the ways to build upon and improve this rules-based international order that has existed for 75 years. And that's where I think the challenge comes in, is that many of the objectives, if you think about China in particular, have broad-based support. But it's the rhetoric and the process that is used to create a wedge, not only between countries, but within our own country. Mm-hmm. And that becomes hugely problematic.
Rudy, how did you react to the comment, the future does not belong to the globalists, the future belongs to patriots?
How do I react to Donald Trump? It's not my area of expertise, Natalie. That rhetoric does not resonate. I was born in Germany, and I'm very, let's say, intimately familiar with the benefits of integration into international systems. Germany is a sort of special case in this regard, and many Germans are very strongly wedded to this rules-based system that Miles alludes to, and still the issue is that this rhetoric has arisen not only in the U.S. but in several other countries as well, because the losers of globalization broadly within the countries have not found political representation, or at least not effective political representation. It is, I agree with many of the statements made here. There's, you know, both Miles and Cole say that there are aggregate gains from trade and countries are net winners. Yes, but within those countries, not enough is being done to manage transition from the structural changes that trade forces upon industries and communities and particular localities. And if there is no answer to these affected communities, they will become amenable to the rhetoric that Trump uses.
Rudy, I love that you are an expert, because that was a great point. Cole, your reaction to it, and I also want you to try and get us to pivot towards what happens when these tariffs are put on these companies.
I like to say I'm a recovering lawyer, but I still am a lawyer, and so rules-based, trade regimen appeals to me, and I think we can see that the benefits over the last few decades. I'm disturbed by, I share Miles' point that some of these agreements, WTO, certainly can be improved. But what I think has been underreported is, for example, is the Trump administration's assault on judges, the WTO judges. They've failed to nominate the American judges to the WTO, which causes backloads in WTO cases. So they're surreptitiously, sub rosa, undermining the operations of the WTO, which I find very disturbing.
Yeah, interesting.
Now, tariffs, let's look at the automobile industry. Tariffs is sort of you have to take a nuanced approach. If BMW wants to export one of its cars that it makes in Spartanburg, South Carolina, to China, and it does a lot, China, before this conflict, imposed just under 25% tariff. If a Chinese company exports, if BMW Brilliance, our company, exports a car to the United States, that 2.5% tariff would be imposed. So a 10 times difference. China has been operating for the last 30 years with a protectionist trade regime.
Begs the question, why are they in the World Trade Organization? But keep going.
Yeah, and they got in under a secret, on a special deal, sort of, that should have been gradually phased out. So there is an issue there. I mean, that's where I'm, a little bit sympathetic to to Trump's, characterization, we're getting ripped off. Now, that's unfair. But I, at the same time, it seems to me his asks, the Trump administration asks, go well beyond trying to balance trade. And trying to eliminate these unfair trade practices. I mean, I think that for the United States to demand that, let me back up and say, I think from the 80s and 90s for China to have a somewhat protectionist tariff regime was probably commonsensical. They were protecting, they were still a developing country, but once it reached, sort of middle income country, as economists define that, it seems that those are no longer defensible. So I definitely support that. Now, trying to correct a trade imbalance is a difficult thing. I mean the Trump administration, for example, they ignored the imbalance in services. We have a huge imbalance in products. Trade and products, but services we have a surplus,
complicated.
Yeah, and trying to dictate to China how to eliminate that trade imbalance, I think, is a very difficult thing. We don't want, as a country, dictating to China to force the private sector in China to make purchases of U.S. goods. That to me is an objective that's inconsistent with our values.
Yeah, interesting. Rudy, you have a comment.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on the issue of the trade deficit because this plays such a big role in the ongoing debates currently. The trade deficit is a funny thing because the vast majority of economists, consensus is that the trade deficit has nothing to do with trade policy. Right? The trade deficit is related to issues of macroeconomics. This is like economists will talk about trade being driven by microeconomic factors on the industry level and such, and the trade deficit on the macro side. That has been really for 40 years terribly unhelpful in the public debate on these issues. The US faces a large trade deficit because it has a large capital surplus because Wall Street is very good at selling securities that are based on the U.S. dollar as the currency. And the U.S. dollar is the currency of the world's most powerful country, and is backed up by the might and power of the U.S. government and this economy. And hence, everybody wants to have these securities. It is the safe security. And so the Wall Street is good at exporting those financial instruments. And so there's a symbiotic relationship between the trade deficit on the one side and the financial surplus on the other side. And that is not commonly well understood in any of these kind of debates.
Miles, a comment on that. And by the way, I loved that differentiation between macroeconomics and microeconomics in the two. And there's a lot of students in the audience that I know benefit from that insight.
You know, I was on TV a few months ago, and they asked me about the deficit and why it's not necessarily a bad thing. I wish that Rudy had been there with me to help explain that. I just wanted to amplify very quickly one thing that Cole said, and I'll put it in my own words. I don't know if you would agree with this 100%. But the fact is that China has not been adhering to the rules of this rules-based international order that we've been talking about. At some point over the next 10 or 15 years, China's going to be the largest economy on Earth. When I was in Beijing last fall, they told me that they have more people making $100,000 per year or more than we have in the entire U.S. workforce. So they have significant economic might, and they have not been a good actor in this rules-based international order. And so one thing that's so complicated with the president's rhetoric, with China in particular, and one reason why you see, despite the rhetoric and the process, I think a lot of people have concerns with, this bipartisan support for some of the objectives the administration is pursuing, is because China is the greatest threat to this rules-based international economic order, not the Trump administration. As much damage as the Trump administration is doing by undermining the WTO, the fact is that if China continues to play by its set of rules, as it increases its economic might around the world, that is going to skew our global economy in a direction that's going to undermine these rules of trade. And that's why it's important as a country that we figure out how to engage with China. How do we update this framework so they can participate, so they then are incentivized to play by the rules, as opposed to what we've seen over the past few decades where they certainly haven't been.
Yeah. All right. So I want to put out a metaphor that for our panelists to think about. Moody's Analytics has called this trade war, they're going to call it trade war chicken. And if you think of, you know, two high school kids out on a backcountry road and they're heading towards each other in a, you know, game of chicken. And if you think about the game of chicken, it's never a situation where both win. They either both collide and die, or, I mean, that's obviously an exaggerated point, or one peels off and one wins. So it's sort of a, you know, colorful metaphor to think about this. Do you guys buy that metaphor? Like, is there a way for the U.S. and China to both benefit here?
You know, well, these two gather the thoughts. We were talking about this a week and a half, 2 weeks ago or so. I think one challenge we have right now is the longer this dispute drags on, the more significant, the higher the costs are for each side, right? You have a situation where both sides need to save face, especially coming into an election year. The Trump administration needs to have any agreement with China be billed as a win for the United States.
And Miles, as they get closer, it also accelerates.
That's exactly right. So now they're accelerating.
The stakes get higher and they start speeding up.
And so the space in which you can achieve a win-win solution, an agreement that both sides can sell to their publics as a win for them, narrows as the wins that both sides have to justify that continue to increase. And so I think we're in a point now where we are accelerating, we are getting closer, and this dynamic has made it harder and harder to find a win-win solution where both sides win and both sides can sell that win to their publics, which is why expediency, urgency is necessary to figure something out and come up with a win-win solution.
Yeah. Rudy, what do you think of the trade war chicken idea?
I think it's a complicated matter. I'm not sure that either country is able to extricate itself in a reasonable way. I want to go back though just for a moment because I'm a social scientist, and I have as well that experience of moving to the US from Germany, and it gives you a slightly different perspective than, you know, being involved in national security policy or diplomacy maybe does. The Trump administration is doing huge damage to the international rules-based system, and China is obviously not the only bad actor here, and not necessarily the dominant one. I want to say that the way this works with chicken is that that if one chicken is an 800-pound gorilla and the other one is a chicken, then it's not much of a game. But
I see your China point. Has, there is a scenario where one
China
does win every
grown
time.
China has to a sizable chicken, and that's all that it is. That the game changes when the chicken becomes a gorilla.
Yeah, we'll pass the microphone to Cole. But Cole, as you take this up. In my own mind, I've wrestled with this thought that in the short run, this will penalize the U.S. economy, but in the long run, if the U.S. prevails and gets China to behave, it could be a win for the U.S. economy. So
that's certainly the Trump administration's line. I mean, my own view is that the chicken metaphor sort of might exaggerate the ability of the two countries to sit down and reach an agreement, provided that both countries are willing to compromise. And it may be that the political bases in each might make that more difficult. But my problem with the Trump administration is that not that some of their asks are very reasonable. China has been, I don't share Miles, quite that negative viewpoint of China as, you know, the consummate violator of rules. I mean, they certainly have violated some trade-based rules, and, you know, technology theft is a key one. But the Trump administration's asks are currently so unreasonable that they're just not, no Chinese leader could accept them. If reason would prevail in the White House on those four boxes that I referred to, you know, I think you can reach an agreement on trade. China will buy more and they'll lower their tariffs. I think you can reach an agreement on market access barriers. China, in my industry, automobile manufacturing, the Trump administration was correct to highlight it as if you wanted to build cars in China, you needed to do it through a joint venture with a Chinese partner, and the foreign manufacturer could only own up to 50% of the joint venture company. That was a huge market access barrier, and China backed away. That was the first compromise they made. That policy goes away in 2022. Technology is a critical issue. The U.S. ask is to stop, you know, China should stop stealing technology. Okay, I mean, everyone agrees China should stop stealing technology. Now, you know, whether they'll do it or not is another question. But that, you know, forcing the actions against Huawei and such, forcing sort of a bifurcation of technology mediums, you know, could cause, I think, a horrible effect on the development of technology around the world. And industrial policy, you know, we don't get a lot of news reporting on this, but guys like, you know, Lighthizer, the U.S. trade rep, and Navarro and Stephen Miller, they want China to cancel its industrial policy, Made in China 2025. It's like the United States is dictating to China to stop adopting a policy that attempts to develop self-sufficiency so they can avoid the kind of things that happened to ZTE. If you follow ZTE, which was a large Chinese cell phone manufacturer, they violated U.S. sanctions and were penalized by the Trump administration by cutting off their supply to U.S. cell chips. The companies that was, it's a huge employer, stopped operations overnight. And if you're a Chinese policymaker, you're going to say, wait, we can't do that. And Made in China 2025 is intended to develop a self-sufficiency. So for the United States to dictate to China to stop doing that is outrageous. And that can't be part of any plan. Now, for the United States to dictate to China to stop stealing technology is a no-brainer.
Very interesting points, Cole. And I know, Miles, it sounds like you've got a little reaction that we'll get from you.
Just real quick. So we talked earlier about how important the WTO is to the global economy, to international trade, how important this rules-based international system is to the continuation of free trade amongst countries. The challenge with Made in 2025, China's agenda, is if you go down the tools that they are using to pursue that agenda, the long list of them are inconsistent with the WTO. They're inconsistent with the commitments that they made when they joined the WTO. So if we care about the WTO, then we ought to care about what China is doing to systematically undermine it down the list, whether it's market access, whether it's subsidizing state-owned enterprises, whether it's stealing not just U.S. intellectual property, but intellectual property from all around the world. All of these things are undermining the WTO. They're undermining this rules-based international system. And that's why in Washington, you actually find bipartisan support to go out to find a way to engage China to address some of these longstanding issues. Of course, it comes back to rhetoric and process. And that's one where I think we have widespread agreement that the rhetoric and process the administration is pursuing may not be the best in order to accomplish these objectives, which very much are to strengthen this rules-based system for international trade.
Very good. Okay, we're going to go out to you for questions. And as we do that, I'm just going to ask each panelist, just as you're formulating your question, this is one of those yes in a sentence kind of responses, because I've sort of failed by not bringing Utah into the picture at all. Miles, has this trade war hurt the Utah economy? And you get to say yes or no in a sentence. And I'm going to ask each of you that.
Yes, it has. It affected primarily companies at this point that have supply chains that depend on China. If we see these tariffs go into effect over the coming months on consumer goods, then we'll have a cost to Utah consumers as well.
Good. Rudy, does it hurt the Utah economy?
I'm not an expert on the Utah economy, but I have to say yes, because my neighbor who works in a clothing company tells me that if these tariffs on pants from China go through, they're going out of business. So, I'm certain that there are adverse effects and the uncertainty matters, and it matters in Utah just as anywhere else in the country.
Cole,
definitely yes. This is a foreign direct investment, a United States statistic, but in 2014, Chinese investment coming into the United States was $50 billion. 2017, $30 billion. Last year, $4.9 billion. So and that obviously affects Utah as well.
That was Cole Kapner, independent director of BMW Brilliance Automotive Incorporated, based in Shenyang, China. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. Once more, here is moderator and director of the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute, Natalie Gochner.
Okay, we've got microphones for questions. Let's have you state your name and speak into the microphone.
My name is Jeff Hunter, and I have a question about the WTO. You said that WTO is not following, that China's not following the rules. Is it possible that China has hijacked the WTO, so now they can do whatever they want?
You know, I'll comment briefly. I have not seen anything to suggest that they've hijacked the WTO or taken over the WTO. I just think that since they joined the WTO, the WTO as an organization has been ineffective in holding China accountable to what it committed to. And I think that obviously we talked earlier about how there's lots of opportunities to modernize and improve the WTO. So it's by no means a perfect institution. It's just the best one that we've come up as a community of nations. And it's one that I think that if we can find a way to strengthen it, like appointing judges to be on the WTO from the U.S. side, those types of actions will help keep countries, hold them accountable to the commitments. And that includes the United States as well. If we are flouting the rules in some areas, I'd like to see an organization that's able to make sure that we are playing by the rules as well. because, again, that rules-based system is very, very important for all countries, including ours.
Looks like you go ahead.
One quick addition to that, the disputes at the WTO between the EU and the US are fascinating to consider because these two large, powerful countries have very often simply not cared about what the WTO says. And so if you're big enough, you kind of do what you want, and you have enough lawyers to drag out cases for 3 decades and keep subsidies to your strategically important industries in place. So both the EU and the US are doing this on a regular basis. And if I were a chicken and want to become a gorilla, I would probably say I have to do the same. And that is, to my mind, the objective assessment and not the one dominated by a specific country interest.
It's like Cole has
A quick comment. My understanding is that the disputes with China and the WTO have almost all, if not all, been ruled against China. Now, it didn't always translate into enforcement, but I think the characterization that the WTO has been hijacked by China is not accurate.
That's great. Looks like we have a comment on the first row.
Ben Collender, Director of Economic Development for Salt Lake City. The question I have is, so we're up here talking about policy, and this is all really relevant at a national level. When we back up to our community, a lot of our businesses are looking at the news and watching all this happen and sometimes catch wind of the impact on them a little too late. What sort of things in your experience should companies be thinking about as the current global climate continues to go down this path? And one practical example I can say from the city side is we have a foreign trade zone, right? And that can't eliminate these tariffs, but it does a lot for the companies to be aware of this, especially some of the larger manufacturers, to understand how they operate and what they could do. What other tools or things should companies be engaged with or thinking about to help them navigate this current climate?
Cole, this sounds like a really good question for you, but Miles went to reach for the mic, so let's see what we want to do.
No. I'll give Cole a second to gather his thoughts. Ben, thank you for the chance to do a little infomercial for World Trade Center Utah. You know, this is what we do, right? We engage Utah companies to help them grow and expand internationally, how to identify what the obstacles are and how to overcome what those obstacles are. We've had a series of events just over the past few months, specifically on China. We've had others on USMCA, our trade agreement that's still needs to be ratified by Congress with Mexico and Canada. Just this morning, we met with people from Indonesia. We've got people from Latin America coming next week. So on a very regular basis, we are helping Utah companies identify what these challenges and opportunities are, then help them take advantage of it or mitigate it if it happens to be a cost or a challenge. And so for anybody who's working with companies, come and talk to us, and we can help put you in touch with experts here in the state who can help you with some of these issues.
Cole?
I make this a further add for you, because I think that, I mean, despite, you know, the political controversy surrounding its establishment, I think the trade zone in Salt Lake is an excellent idea and a good tool, one of few actually available for small businesses to take advantage of.
Remind our audience what the free trade zone does for businesses in our state.
It allows customs-free, duty-free importation of goods. I'm not sure exactly, I've seen the evolution of these free trade zones in China and how successful they have been there in growing production capacity, improving Chinese, you call it lai liao jiagong. You bring in imported parts from global supply chains, make your iPhone, and then go out without, you know, incurring various costs. Yeah. So right. you can increase logistics efficiency, reduce customs clearance and tariff kinds of burdens. It's been, very effective in other countries around the world, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it works in Utah. I think it should be an effective tool. I also think that, just briefly, that I'm thinking that this is an the current administration is an aberration for this tariff kind of trade wars. I think it'll be short-lived.
Okay. Other questions? Please, on the front row here, just give us your name and speak into the microphone.
My name is Finn, and I guess whoever can answer this one, I've got questions about, you know, as the trade war escalates, what is China and the U.S., but specifically China, doing looking for markets outside of the U.S. and the EU, like in Latin America, Asia, and Africa, kind of with the One Belt, One Road initiative?
You go, Rudy.
Maybe just a short comment. One thing that that has happened with the EU-China trade is that, as the textbook would suggest it does, is trade diversion. So the EU has slapped punitive tariffs on bicycles from China. And hence, the bicycle imports from Morocco, I believe, if I remember correctly, all of a sudden quintupled. And there were actually Chinese bikes, obviously. And so the EU slapped these tariffs all over these other countries. So the lesson is that that these costs are going to be, the companies and countries will try to avoid these costs and go to other countries. And in the same way, my neighbor who's working in a clothing company, they're already exploring to source from countries in Eastern Europe, such as Romania or Bulgaria, or they will go to Vietnam. And so it will hurt China, and to the extent that there are real investment costs to relocate plants and establish these new relationships, it will cost U.S. corporations as well.
You want to say anything, Miles? Or?
I just had the One Belt, One Road is a fascinating initiative. So it's China looking at Central Asia, Africa, the Middle East, you know, these trade routes. Ultimately into Europe as well. And I just would comment that it is a priority for China. They're making tremendous investments in Central Asia, in the Middle East, in Africa as well. And I do think that this is not just a result of the trade dispute with the United States, but they view those markets and those trade routes as being increasingly important in the decades to come. And in China, they're great at long-term strategic thinking. So this is something that they are persistently working on and will continue to do, I think, regardless of what happens with the United States.
Okay, I'm not seeing a hand. Okay, let me just ask. Well, let's go right here. I'm going to go to. Are you a student? I hope that's a compliment.
I'm Erin. I was a student. Excellent. I'm now a staff person, and I teach international affairs here. I have a question for Miles. You made a comment about how trade creates people-to-people ties between nations, and I want to maybe push you to expand on that a little bit. I'm thinking about your backgrounds in the Middle East. So like Saudi Arabia, right? It looks like that's an example of a place where we have an economic tie that's actually inhibiting us from maybe adjudicating human rights violations or, you know, this positive cultural exchange of ideas that would help uplift the people in both places. So I'm wondering, China's not Saudi Arabia, but they have their own list of concerning human rights violations, and they, you know, this concerning behavior about how they're policing people on social media and things like that. So how do we foster economic ties with them that also foster accountability rather than like putting us in a position where we're tied to them economically, so now we can't comment on some of these things?
Yeah, no,
really interesting question.
Excellent, excellent question. Really great points. I think that Iran actually gives an interesting, I think Saudi Arabia and Iran together give an interesting example that as important as these economic ties are, it creates relationships, but depriving the economic benefits isn't sufficient to change a country in their approach to human rights, as we see with Iran, right? We've deprived Iran all these economic benefits, but it's not really moving the needle in terms of human rights in Iran, at least as of yet. In Saudi Arabia, we do have these relationships. It is something that we maintain and grow and expand, and then we use those relationships to, on a regular basis, engage Saudi Arabia on human rights, on the principles of a free, open society, all these other things. But we see in Saudi Arabia's case that as of yet, you know, there has been some progress, but it hasn't been like a night and day difference, right? And so it's important to think to keep in mind the importance of these people-to-people ties. But at the end of the day, I think we have to be very circumspect as Americans on our ability to reshape other countries in our image. And that's one of the biggest lessons, biggest takeaways I had out of spending a lot of time in the Middle East, is I think we need to be pretty humble about how much we can dictate to other countries, what their values are, how they organize their societies, and how they treat their people. It doesn't mean that we're not obligated to share our good news, if you will, to help stand up for the principles that we live by. But at the end of the day, I don't think that we can use, whether it's economic or military or any other tool in our toolbox, to really truly reshape another country that doesn't want to pick up our value systems and do what we are doing. And if they end up doing it, like maybe Germany or Japan after World War II, it's because they want to. They view that it's in their interest, not because we are applying any sort of pressure or telling them that's what they need to do.
Rudy, I'd love to hear your comments.
Yeah, I'm glad that Miles brings up our values. I think that that sort of gives me the opportunity to go back to the point about the losers. Because if you think just for a second about what the way that our discussion has been going now for the last hour is that we're talking geopolitics and state-state competition and international organizations, we have largely not picked up the topic of how within this country we're going to address the social dislocation that arises in many parts of the country where manufacturing has essentially disappeared. The problems with the opiate epidemic and vast unemployment or a decline in real incomes and the rise in inequality are connected to the type of globalization that the U.S. has managed to implement over the last 30 to 40 years. And there are many positive aspects, as has been mentioned, the rules-based aspects of this. When we think about how to make this work within our own country, we have to think about the losers and how to effectively address their specific situations.
Very nice. I'm going to go ahead and just ask the last question because I've got a real good one for him. We'll start with you, Cole, and here it is. President Trump hands you his phone, and he invites you to send a message regarding trade. You got 280 characters. What would you write? It's just this really because he's saying, "Okay, here's my phone. What would you write? What would you want to come out of that
I'd
communication?"
Call the view? Ukrainian president first. We need a deal. We need a trade deal, and it's achievable if both parties negotiate in good faith.
Great message. Rudy, this is a real power you've got here.
What we need is think about effective ways of what is commonly called a flexicurity system. This is Econ 101. If you have international economic integration and the pressure from international competition, you need to have systems in place that protect people from dislocation. That was like 120 characters.
It's okay. You know what's interesting is you just can't see that coming out of our president's mind, but it's really good. Okay, bring us home, Miles.
Perfection is the enemy of good. And we're at the point now where we need some good deals, even if we don't get perfect deals, because the pursuit of the ultimate deal has significant costs for all of us and our relationships with our partners around the world.
Great. Let's give our panelists a hand.
We're wrapping things up there. If you'd like to hear the full Q&A section or listen to another Hinckley Forum, you can find them on our website, kcpw.org, or on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour podcast. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.